we do now, to some extent, even though the government has changed. So the early contact was, of course, with when Peter the Great was there. But I suppose there's no one thing stands in that background with a more rich heritage than that left by Daniel Wheeler, an English friend who was an agriculturist, also a drainage engineer, and he went to St. Petersburg on concern to see whether there's something friends ought to be doing in Soviet Union or in Russia, which was before the revolution. He stayed the rest of his life. He came back a number of times. He eventually brought his wife and five children. They lived there, and the children lived and died all too young because of disease. The swamps were drained under the sponsorship of, under his direction and the support of the Tsar. The agricultural practices around St. Petersburg were completely transformed, and the crop production was up three times what they had been accustomed to get. She talked in language that even a rather stupid Tsar could understand. They stayed on through Peter the Great, Karajan the Great, not the Great, and then Alexander, who was a quite stupid inheritor of the throne, and died, all of them died there finally. And there's a little cemetery just outside St. Petersburg, now Leningrad, where it was all in disarray 30 years ago. And Gilbert Master, who represented the Church Committee in Berlin, made a trip to Russia, and he had a concern to see if he could find the grave of Daniel Wheeler. Well, he found this grave with five children, the wife and Daniel Wheeler, but it was in terrible condition. And he laid this before the Soviet government, which was the new government of Russia. And they cleaned it up, put a nice wall around it, and guaranteed it perpetual care, which is true, as I understand it. Some have visited there since. Well, this is relatively unimportant. It's a relatively small incident in terms of the great sweep of political facts in the world. Nevertheless, it's a rich background of pure spiritual concern carried out in the material things of life, which is quite a revelation to the Russians, and still is a revelation to the. Now that book will tell you a number of other people who are succeeding him did a variety of things in Russia. Now, of course, it's an organized exchange between them and us, and that was slow in developing, a good deal of nourishing, but never underestimate the value of something like that that is done because you feel it ought to be, you ought to do it. He didn't wait for the early meeting to act. They probably never would have acted if he had. London early meeting at that time was pretty slow and conservative. Now, of course, they have a committee, as we do in this country, to undertake these more expensive projects. Well, one wonders what's happening in Algeria. Algeria was now, it comes as near being a relief situation as we have. It's just emerging from handing out food and clothing to a little more orderly way of carrying on life. But now the Algerians fought for 7 years for their independence. And in that process, village after village, over one-third of the total of the area were either wiped out or had barbed wire entanglements around them and compelled people to stay inside the entanglements. Then when the war ended, they found that the fields, just like fields around here, instead of being open and ready to go back to the fields they had, first of all, to dig up the bombs that had been buried there by the French, by the thousands. So that it was an enormous job. It has to be said, for the credit of the French, that the French participated in that process of de-bombing fields. There's a new day. Think about the relation, how terrible the Japanese were a few years ago. The emperor had great cheese protruding out here, and all these wicked things. Now we love the Japanese. And I was interested, just listening on the radio today, which is not a very commendable development, but to hear that Germany is sending arms to Israel to defend her against her neighbors. And it hasn't been too long since that couldn't have happened. One thing we can do is keep our heads on things when people get all hot and bothered about something that is going wrong and make life confusing about it. Well, we passed through the most difficult period of the Algerians. Now we're helping them reestablish themselves in their villages and reestablish their schools, reestablish hand reading, which is important to them, and to help them with the problem with agriculture, because their agriculture was pretty primitive. We have a staff of, I guess, about 15 people there, and now they have to be trained people who know how to help at the more difficult social contributions than just the distribution of relief. One doesn't know where that will end. What does it mean, for instance, that we're in Hong Kong? Hong Kong has a population of 1 million people. It has a refugee population of 125 million, of 1,250,000 Chinese who have come over the border, pushed over the border, probably in some cases going voluntarily. And they're not the most educated Chinese. One wonders whether the Chinese aren't sort of dumb. We went out to the border when we were in Hong Kong and watched them coming off of the train, coming down from Canton on the 9 miles up the line. And I think very likely the facts are that the Chinese have, the food hasn't been too plentiful in China, and they're getting rid of people that are welfare cases that would be with us. That's part of the problem, but not the whole problem. But here are these people, reproducing at a rapid rate. Nothing else much to do but to reproduce. And reproduce they do. We sent over a young woman just recently to study what can be done to help the women who are distressed, because by the force of circumstances under which they live, they are almost forced to have one child right after another, and here you're building up a population that has no basis of support except for relief, which is furnished by the city of Hong Kong and indirectly by the British government. In that situation, one of the things that we have found that we don't try to do the relief job is just wholly beyond it, involved. But one of the things is to get the women together into various kinds of crafts and sewing and things of that sort that they can do, and give them some outlet rather than live as they often do, four families in one little house with one kitchen for four families and very limited rations, which are furnished free by the city government. One certainly doesn't know where this comes out. Nevertheless, I don't think Jesus would have asked the question, whether you are, should we go over there after all, from the Chinese? We don't like the Chinese politically. And there's plenty of things here to do at home. Certainly are plenty of things to do here at home. I think we feel pretty strongly that our Christian faith says that is not the way to treat even the least of these. Some of these people are among the least. Not all of them by any means, but some of them. And one never knows when treating a situation of that sort, when in the long run it comes back in fruit in terms of opening doors. How long am I talking? Well, I talked a little bit longer, and then I'll leave some time for questions. I would like to say something about Cuba, but I'm not. We have been able to break down the barriers in Cuba. We are, I think all of us in the service committee and most friends would feel that it's a great pity ever to cut ourselves off politically from another country. What you want to do, even if it's unpopular, is to try to get in to know what's going on and to know the people who are responsible for the changes. You may not like them, you may disagree with them, but you can't be affected unless you know something about them firsthand. Well, we broke a little through a little. The State Department finally let us take $30,000 worth, fly over the $30,000 worth of medicine, which we took over and distributed. And people spent about 2 weeks. We've had a number of short 2 week visits to Cuba. Partly because we wanted to sort of stand by the friends, the 300 or 400 friends there in the Cuban mission, results of Cuban mission. But also because it's close to us, they have been friends of us, Cubans have. We exploited Cuba, and we've also helped Cuba to develop. That remains a problem that we have not, however, by any means conquered as to what we ought to do. One of the things that emerges as you move from the stage of the relatively simple job of delivering relief, you come to a country that's in great distress because of famine or war or whatever it may be, and you are welcome because they are in such distress. But then when they are able to go on their own, one thing to know is when to go home, when to let them take over and to go home. But also, as I have tried to point out, you find new problems emerging, and by all means, in many respects, the most important person who can do something about these problems are the people who represent the government officially. Now, I say that guardedly because I remember to recognize that an individual minister or a Christian going and rendering a great service. But at the same time, the attitude of a whole country can be affected by the attitude of its diplomatic representatives as well as its public officials. With that in mind, and finding so often that the younger generation of diplomats going into from one country into another huddle together with other younger diplomats but have very little contact with the people of the community and very little contact with the other diplomats except at cocktail parties, which is one of the world's worst places to get to know people. So we decided 12 years ago, see what could be done, he said. And we opened a seminar on Lake Geneva, up from the city of Geneva, for younger diplomats and their families. We invited them to come for our seminar. 10 days, free. We fed them, we bedded them, we provided recreation in the afternoon. We provided some special attention to the women, but in the morning, the men were to be in conference with some person whom we felt and whom they agreed were who had something to contribute to the thinking of the responsibility of the young man who goes abroad to represent his country. We had about 30 of them at the time, and they even take off their coats sometimes. Once in a while, roll up their sleeves. They get to be human beings, talking together as human beings. They come from all countries with a few exceptions. The Israelis say, we won't come if there's an Arab there. And the Arabs say, we won't come if there's an Israeli there. The Chinese have not yet been willing to come. We've had now several probably countries in the Far East. And once or twice they have come. But they have said, we will not come if the United States is represented there. We don't care about the administration of it. Paul Johnson is the administrator, and he's an American. We put up with him. But a diplomat from the United States, we will not sit down with. That still is a stone wall, pretty much. This has gone on for 12 years. I have in my briefcase at home a list of about 700 young men who have our diplomats and who have participated in these various conferences in various parts of the world. We just told one just last week in Cambodia, for instance. We have a series of them going on in Africa where the problems are very different. Now, all of these are an attempt to say, let me put it as it seems to me, we have tried in this country to apply Christian principles to public life. We haven't done it too well. We've done it so inadequately that a great many conscientious Christians can't hold public office. I know that. Let us confess our shortcomings and be very humble. The fact remains that there is a testimony growing out of the New Testament, out of the experience of friends over the years, that you can break down barriers between people, you can bring out of people something that is better than they thought was in them by the way you treat them. And that's the thing we're trying to do. It's by no means uncomplicated. For instance, I just had a letter yesterday from Nora Booth, who handled the video of this in her office in Philadelphia, saying, the Pakistani are kicking up their heels. Now, we are having a conference, got where it is in India. The Pakistani say, in India? Well, we've gone, but the barrier between us and the Indians has grown higher. And I'm not sure. So I happen to know there's a Prabhu Khan who's been the member, head of the delegation at the Pakistan delegation at the UN. I've known him for a number of years. He's been at our home. He calls Lily by her first name. Always, when he comes in the door, he says, now tell me again which is east. And she tells him where east is. And then he goes and puts his rug down and has his prayer towards Mecca. He's okay by us. he's now a member of one of the judges on the International Court in The Hague. But he still has good standing in Pakistan. So she asked me if I would write him a letter saying, would he be willing to use his influence to say that we're not as bad as you might think we are, that we think we can get along with both Pakistani and Indians. We have done it in the past, and the Pakistani don't know it as well as the Indians do when it comes. But this kind of thing keeps cropping up. It only emphasizes the importance of keep plugging away at respecting those things that are of value in the people, no matter whether they're Muslims or Hindus or what they are. If they become Christians, fine. If they practice their Islamic rituals with deeper spiritual significance, that's fine. And I suppose for many of us, that raises with us the question, as to whether what Jesus would have done under those circumstances. Would he have said, would he have turned his attention to making them followers of a sect of which he was the head? Well, he didn't talk that very much about the Samaritan or the woman taken in adultery. Don't have any really clear-cut illustrations coming out of the New Testament. But anyway, we have gone this road, and it's a road that's difficult but extremely interesting and very rewarding in terms of appreciation in the long run. It's the author's patience sometimes it's a very long run. Just a word or two now about civil rights. That's come to the fore as the, I suppose, the most important question for most Americans, most conscientious Americans. I only want to say nothing new. We've had concern about civil rights, certainly ever since the days of William Penn, John Woolman was very keen about civil rights. I want to raise some of the questions that come up. I just might say that we do have individuals, one working in Atlanta, for instance, on the question of employment, on the basis of ability and not on the basis of color. A new center has grown up in Atlanta, new meetings have grown up there, and quite a development in Atlanta. We have a young man and his family living in New Orleans, working at the same kind of job, employment on merit and not on color. We have people working in Mississippi, and this summer, 3 years of meetings got excited about maybe they ought to do something about Mississippi. So New York gave a meeting, Philadelphia gave a meeting, and Pacific gave a meeting, all said we want to do something. Nothing I like better as a person who lives in the service committee media than to find your meeting getting excited about something they do on their own steam. It's very healthy, I think. Well, they sent down representatives and came back recommending that these 3 year meetings join forces in rebuilding some of the burned churches. 33 of them burned down, 35, not two more burns that they've been down there. They've got a little staff down there now, working along with the Negro who joined the worship in the church, but now and again a white man who will join him because he is penitent for what's happening in Mississippi. There are people there who don't like what's happening in Mississippi, who don't agree with it, and who are willing even to risk their standing in the community by working on Negro, rebuilding Negro churches. One business firm was even willing to contribute material to rebuild. It's a little mixed picture because my first reaction was, here we're just augmenting the segregation of the church. Burning down a Negro church may offer the chance to have a colored and white church built. Can't go that fast, frankly. Everybody who's been down there said, no, let's bring Negroes back in worship in their own way in their own church. The next step will have to come after. Well, those are some of the things. There's a whole bevy of things that are happening, but I don't want to take time. I just want to leave you uncomfortable with a few questions in your mind. Perhaps the first one would be in relation to the civil rights field. Something that's come up the last few days. Vietnam commenced. I don't have to argue that case, I think. We have made a proposal to the government for possibly emerging from that. One of the things is the chairman of the service committee, Gilbert White, was a member of the team of British, French, and Americans who mapped out the problems of drains in Mekong Valley so that it would not flood the field. That applies to North Vietnam, South Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and Thailand. That has gone on straight through all of the stress, except the North Vietnamese are not willing to participate. But the rest of them have gone right on in spite of the political complications. That gave us a little clue. The second thing is that they had a pretty bad typhoon in South Vietnam. And first, the State Department told us there were 5,000 people killed, and they said, no, that was an exaggeration of 500. But terrible devastation of property, crops, and villages. And we thought maybe we'd hook on somewhere to that as a relief problem, and the support of the government continued in the Mekong Valley development, and turn the attention in that direction rather than the continued killing off of North Vietnamese and South Vietnamese and some of our own soldiers, and getting them there as far as an ordinary observer can tell. I'm afraid I have very little hope of this having any bearing on stopping the comments, is probably one of the ways of opening the way for comments competition, rather than preventing to go on to a futile war. Chinese are very clever at letting the Vietnamese get killed off, and let us get killed off, and not themselves, for the present. So I don't know what will happen to that, but what should we do about that? I have a letter on the dining room table in the little house we're living in, asking me to sign petitions which is to be sent to the president, saying we don't approve of the Vietnamese war. We want to stop, and stop now. We pledge ourselves to do our best to stop it. We will discourage anybody from accepting the draft because he might be drafted to go to Vietnam. We will make demonstrations in front of areas where war preparation is going on, missile bases and so on. I think there's a third one, which is civil disobedience, which might easily put us in jail. Now, friends have done pretty well getting in jail over the years. They have a pretty good record, I think, of being in jail when they ought to be. Thoreau and his uncle went to see him and said, what are you doing in that jail? Thoreau said, what are you doing outside of the jail? In terms of standing by our convictions, when we are convinced the government is wrong and taking the consequences, we have something of a tradition. Not all friends are willing to do that, but many have been. And there are times when that seems to be the thing that jars the government to different kind of action. Should I sign that petition? I think that is a naughty question to lay it on you to help me answer. I'm just not quite clear. I think the present procedure is perfectly wicked. And our government is doing it. And my tax money, small though it is going to support it. Well, the other one was used to pay income tax despite this war, which is one thing that could be done and which would, of course, get us into trouble. But many other people have that same kind of trouble and have been killed as a result of it. These are some of the kinds of things that we get into in the field of civil rights. I think we have to respect profoundly the way in which the Negro group has used this, what I consider, under the present circumstances, a legitimate tool of protesting against things which the government does, which we disapprove of and do not want by our silence to allow to continue. There are plenty of people in the early stages of our own government used civil disobedience. Gandhi used it to bring about Indian independence with great effect. Well, I'm not saying here what we ought to do, and nobody does this lightly, certainly. Not a lot of things to do. Can't dump the courts and take them to jail and lose time and so on. But it sometimes may be the price that has to be paid. Well, I'm sure I ought to stop now. I just want to say one more thing. And that is somewhat unrelated here, what I've been saying. But I do think that the opportunity for the younger generation, upper high school and particularly college age, and some older people who have good health and skills, to use them in terms of the need of the world at this confused stage when change is going on so rapidly. There's some things that are obvious. The visit and living with people who are underprivileged and putting yourself down alongside them for 2 years, as the Peace Corps people do, as our visa people do, is a thing that has not changed in its nature of its value over the years.